My guest is Frank Byrd. He founded Fielder Capital Group. He has worked for Merrill Lynch as a financial consultant years ago. He got his MBA from Columbia Business School, which is important to this story, as you'll hear a little bit later. And he's a chartered financial analyst, which makes him a professional in a very professional business. I recently read an article that he wrote and realized that he and I have a lot in common. So I've invited him to the show to talk about, of all things, Warren Buffett. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
So you started in the brokerage world. You were very, very young, I understand, and you worked for Merrill Lynch. I worked for Merrill Lynch many years ago. And, you know, it's a high-pressure sales environment where people could make an awful lot of money. And it was kind of a culture of just that, of, you know, trying to generate as many commissions as possible. And then you discovered Warren Buffett, I guess, relatively early on. How did that change you?
So I'd been at Merrill Lynch for about 3 years, and having been a political science major, not knowing anything, I naturally read as much research as I could, and none of it ever really sat with me. And then one day, I walked into a senior broker's office. I kept asking him, why can't we put money with money managers that do what I've seen succeed with the individual investors I've met? Steve, by that I mean that I had been the cold call cowboy. I made 40 cold calls a day for 2 years. It's over 11,000 people. And that obviously introduced me to a lot of real people. These were typically older investors. It takes a while to accumulate wealth. And what I saw had worked for them was that they had bought and held shares of companies that they understood, many of them, you know, a regional company like a Federal Express, Procter & Gamble, Shearing Plough, Coca-Cola. And having bought several dozen of these over the course of many years, decades, they wake up with many of them very large portfolios. I'm talking $1 million, and that's in the early 1990s in Memphis, Tennessee, mind you. So I knew that that worked. And to be clear, these weren't high income professionals. Many of these were people that had never made over $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
And so I knew what worked. I saw it. And unfortunately, everything I read with the typical Wall Street research didn't really sit with me because I couldn't tie it to reality.
Yeah.
And one day, accidentally, this broker said, hey, I'll bet you'd like this. I picked up the Berkshire Hathaway report. I took it home that night, and it changed my life.
Yeah.
For the first time, I read something that made sense. Mm. Buy shares of great businesses run by great people at good to great prices and hold them a long time. Like, that works. Mm-hmm. I can sell that because it's the truth.
Yeah, you could believe in what you were actually selling because you had the sense that these things worked. I had a similar experience myself. When I worked for Merrill Lynch, there was the head of research there was a value manager, and he would espouse the concepts of value investing. And that's really the first time. Nobody ever trained me on any of this stuff. It was always, you know, you go to New York and you learn how to sell options, you learn how to you know, trade bonds and things like that. But nobody ever actually said, you know, here's an investment philosophy. So, you know, that's when I got introduced to Warren Buffett. Plus, you know, his plain spoken way and his ability to kind of use common sense as a platform for explaining how things work really did resonate with me. Now, Frank, you then decided to go back to school and you went back to Columbia, or you went to Columbia, right?
Absolutely. After, you know, I went to several Berkshire meetings, I read everything I could about this person, and he genuinely changed my life. I finally made up my mind. And back then, I was looking for money managers who were investing in the way that I knew Buffett invested, which simplistically put, meant they didn't own that many stocks. They weren't over diversified. They had a value orientation, and they had a very low portfolio turnover. They were very close to buy and hold. And when I did a search on this big database, and in the mid 90s, it spit out, Steve, literally, I think there were six managers that spit out of this search among thousands of managers that had a decent track record. I think I was looking for 5 years or more that were practicing this craft. And I remember many of the six firms that were on that list half of which were closed to new investors.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, there must be a shortage of people out there that are doing this. So why don't I go off and learn how to do it myself?
So you went to Columbia because Buffett, well, that was Buffett's alma mater, and that's where he
absolutely
he worked with Ben Graham and followed the Graham and Dodd, you know, philosophies of investing. So you actually went right to the source. So that's really pretty commendable. So all of these years have gone by, and you know, Buffett has espoused this philosophy of investing and looking at price as a very important factor, and not timing the market, not trading a lot, but actually, like you said, buying great businesses and holding them. And then also this idea that most of the world, especially the academic world, was espousing this efficient market theory, which is that all the information is known about the markets and so on, so that you can never really get an edge. And yet, you know, Buffett was clearly getting an edge, and there was a number of individuals that he, you know, highlighted that were also getting an edge. And so that went on for years and years until about 3 years ago. He shocked everybody by saying, forget all that. Now everybody should go buy index funds. And that's the point I really want to get to today, because that is, you know, that's the shot heard around the world to all these money managers. So, so take me through that. What are your colleagues saying about that now that he's touting the S&P 500?
It's an interesting question. Honestly, you know, I'm a fairly social being, and I have a lot of friends in the business, and, you know, we grab coffee. My sense is, you know, the New York crowd is still kind of numb. I don't hear much commentary. This is going to surprise you. Most of my friends, and proud to say that I know people that I think of as some of the best in the industry, would tell you that if they were looking over the shoulder of their financial advisor, or say their father or their uncle's financial advisor, and they saw that that advisor had them in an index fund, most would say, phew. I think they'd have a sigh of relief.
They'd be relieved.
And so there is this acknowledgement that most of the industry is guilty of closet indexing. And when I use that term, what I mean, Steve, I'm sure you know what that means, but for those listeners who don't, closet indexing basically means that a money manager has a portfolio that is constructed so closely to resemble the index in terms of a large number of companies and very close in terms of mix of industries, that in essence, it basically looks like the index.
With one major difference, and that is the index that you buy costs next to nothing, but these people are charging what?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look, the you'll see different studies. The number has been coming down. I think the last number I saw, you'll see the number thrown out, I think. Mm-hmm. Don't quote me on this. Of course, this is broadcast. But the number is going to be roughly in the neighborhood of 0.75%. Mm-hmm. However, what those numbers often don't capture is that on top of that, there is a 12b1 selling fee that's typically another 25 basis points or 0.25%.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is this hidden cost that nobody talks about, but a few academics have attempted to try to quantify. And that's the enormous tax that high turnover, meaning a lot of buying and selling in the portfolio, extracts from the returns of an account. Now, there are several studies on this, and they all reach slightly different conclusions. But the studies, some of them conclude that the buying and selling friction costs could amount to as much as 1 percentage point additional drag.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, let's just broaden this out a little bit. So, if you buy General Electric stock, and let's say it's $33 a share, and then you want to sell it, it's let's say it's 32.75. So there's a quarter of a point difference between what you have to buy it at and what you have to sell it at. That spread is a cost of doing business, and that spread is what you're talking about. It's that hidden differential between the higher price you have to pay and the lower price you have to sell it at. Plus, you have to pay taxes on a portfolio that's managed actively, because anybody who owns a mutual fund and gets a tax bill at the end of the year knows that that manager's been selling stock, and you've got to pay taxes on the capital gains that were generated. So there's a few things at play here. The manager's fee, plus the selling fee, you mentioned this 12B1, plus this bid spread differential, plus the fact that if you have to pay taxes, you know, on the gains, it reduces your return. And that's, I think, why Buffett likes to hold on to things so long, because he says the government basically is subsidizing his taxes.
Absolutely. Look, I don't believe Buffett feels that he has the time to go this much in depth. I think he's trying to communicate a very simple, straightforward message. But I think one thing that maybe doesn't get enough attention is that the S&P 500 turns over, meaning the buying and selling in the S&P 500 is practically zero. And when I say practically, it's in the neighborhood of 5%. Maybe in some years it could trend up to 10%.
I agree.
But that's a very low turnover because the average portfolio manager, the last numbers I saw at least, were turning their portfolios over 100%. That means that literally they've bought and sold the entire portfolio within a year.
Yeah.
Now, what I found ironic is I would go to these Berkshire Hathaway meetings and you'll see all these money managers show up and they all seem to listen on the edge of their seat to his every word. And I always thought it was ironic. I'd look around and I'd see people that I knew were very active traders. And it just was weird to me that they would get back on that plane and go back to New York and seemingly disregard this buy and hold mentality. So I believe Buffett's big attraction to the S&P 500 is at least he knows it's low turnover. And that means not just the low management fee, which is, of course, very, very low compared to the 1%, the 3/4 to 1.5% range that a typical money manager is going to charge. On top of that, the S&P 500 is not engaging in a lot of activity, and that means less friction cost and less taxes.
All right, so here's a problem that I have. Myself being in the business for 35 years and really steering clients towards the creation of wealth and financial planning and this kind of thing. But here's the problem that I see with this idea of it's just about the S&P 500. And by the way, I totally agree that index funds are really the way to go.
Yep.
Very hard for an active manager to capture excess return to justify their fees. No question about it. But I think the average person can't stand the idea of doing nothing for 25 years because it's more psychological. I mean, even Buffett said the other day in a CNBC interview, he said that there were three times since he's owned Berkshire Hathaway that that stock, Berkshire Hathaway stock, has gone down 50%. Now, maybe a guy like Buffett can hold on when stocks go down because he really understands the value of the company that he owns and the companies that he buys. But the average person doesn't have a clue. They see a number rising and falling every day when they check their phone or they check their statements. They don't have any idea. And when things go bad, everybody's asking me these days, hey, Steve, is there a time we should sell? This looks like a fake rally to me. Shouldn't we sell? And I think it's human nature to ask that question. What do you think?
Look, I think Buffett, so first, on the issue of all of a sudden, he's now telling people to be passive investors when over his career, he's been an active investor.
And he, by the way, I don't mean to interrupt, but he also hires two individuals, Todd and Ted. Yes. Why isn't he investing his company's money in the S&P 500?
The simple answer, Buffett knows active management can work. He knows that it is very rare, not because it is so impossible for some people to consistently do better than average. We know there are a subset of doctors that will consistently do better than average medical care. What I believe is unstated, and I encourage everyone to read the latest Berkshire Hathaway report. He makes no bones about that indexing is not just something that the small investor should be doing, but it's something that the large investor should be doing. I believe the reason, if you read his written statements carefully, it really focuses on this idea that the typical choice to most people is a large money manager. And he is very explicit that size is the enemy of performance. I call it the conspiracy of scale. Mm-hmm. You know, the investing public, you know, if you think of them as consumers of Wall Street goods, the dirty secret of our business, Steve, is that the money management business has diseconomies of scale. By that, I mean, the more money you manage, the worse your returns are going to be. Yeah. And because Buffett acknowledges the reality that the big money management firms, which is just practically where most people are going to have to invest their money, all but the index funds are going to give an inferior result. So he's not saying that there aren't some good money managers out there, but it's typically going to be the small ones. And for the typical person, even professional investor, to be able to identify in advance the small manager that they can get into, that, by the way, will have the integrity to remain small, meaning keep themselves closed to new investors past a certain size, he knows that's not going to happen. So look, I've come into this business as an active manager. I know alpha is possible. I have yet to hire an active manager. I take that back. I hired an active manager for an international allocation. And then Murphy's Law, he literally retires 2 months after I hired him. And do you know how hard, well, you do know how hard it is because you and I are in the same business. You know how hard it is to find active managers where you know you have great confidence as a fiduciary that I am doing a better job giving my clients money to this manager over and above an index.
Well, we got to stop right here. My guest, Frank Byrd, founder of Fielder Capital. And you've got to hear a little bit of an insider's discussion on some of the investment issues of the day. And now that Buffett has come out with his annual report as he prepares for the annual meeting in May, we get a chance to talk about one of our favorite subjects. So Frank Byrd from Memphis, Tennessee, joining me today. Thank you very, very much. And don't forget to find out more about Frank and to hear this conversation and interview again. Join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you, Steve.